Hey you, wherever you are in the world right now, thank you so much for being here with me. We know that we're living in some crazy times and we know that the world is changing. So let's create a bridge as we travel through one another's countries, removing all the labels, coming together as one people in our one world. And as we do this, this is why our signature talk today, Wonderfully Worthy, is so important. Today, I am honored and grateful to have my guest speaker, Anne C.K. Nickel. Hi, Anne.
Hey there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Thank you so much for being with us. Anne is an author, a survivor, and a life transformation coach who founded Wonderfully Worthy Women to use her experiences and her stories to help other women overcome their obstacles, pursue their passions and purpose, and rewrite their story so that they can live their own beautiful lives. I love this, Anne. This is so incredibly amazing. And, you know, offline, we were talking a little bit. I know you have this really powerful story. So I think what we're going to do is we're just going to go and back up to the beginning and, you know, start where you're a little girl. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I was born and raised in a very tiny little town in Iowa. Had wonderful parents, great family, but I did deal with some, you know, rough times and some bullying and things like that growing up in that little town. So that's where my story kind of started.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about what this bullying was about.
Well, I was in our little town. It was so small that we had to be combined with another school in a different town. And, you know, the people in that town had the big lake. They were known for, you know, having more money than those of us from the other little town. And so, you know, for a lot of us, or some of us, it was, you know, a little bit rough because we didn't quite fit in with the kids from the other town. And I felt that, you know, growing up, that, you know, our family didn't have the money that some of those kids had. And plus, I was a little bit different. That town was very well known for its sports, pretty much everything. The girls, you know, basketball, volleyball, guys' sports, you know, they always ended up going to state. Everything was focused on the importance of sports. So for someone like me, who was a writer and a singer and had that creative side, I never felt like I fit in. And I was treated that way by some of the kids. And, you know, I would, you know, get off the school bus and be called fat, you know, by some of the more popular kids. They would, you know, draw ugly pictures of me in art class or just make fun of my family. And so there was a lot of that, you know, bullying going on, and it was a lot of pressure for a teenage girl to have to deal with. So yeah. it was hard.
I can relate to the bullying, you know, situation, because that's something that I dealt with. And just growing up with my grandparents at that time, kids didn't grow up with their grandparents. They always had a mom and dad. So it was a similar situation. And to the point that for me, some of the bullying was a very physical kind of situation where, you know, they would punch or kick or, you know, things that were just very harsh and very mean. So I can relate to the bullying part of your story. And it does create a lot of, I guess, decharacterization of a person as far as how they feel about their self-worth and, you know, how they're showing up in the world. Because the fact that you're different or you look different or you're doing different things, like you said, you were singing or doing art or, you know, writing in your case. I mean, the fact that you're different is exactly what you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be different. Like, that's why you're here, because you're supposed to be different. So I find it interesting how the bullying situation is like, you know, conforming to be like everybody else is really not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be different. So the fact that you're pouring your heart into your writing, you're doing all of these things with, you know, going into adolescence, how does your life change as you're going through adolescence, and what happens?
Well, I focused a lot on my writing. And as I shared with you earlier, I don't believe I ever seriously considered suicide, but yet those thoughts did go through my head. You know, I was depressed. I was sad all the time. But my way of coping was my writing. And so I put that into my poetry. I would write poems about someone who was considering suicide and, you know, trying to put that out there. And that was my way of getting it out of my system so that, you know, it was a way of sharing it so that I didn't want to pursue it. But as I told you, I did tend to scare my parents a little bit with some of that, because they would end up reading some of these things and, you know, sit me down and talk to me. And, you know, luckily I had them. They were good parents. I had their love and support. And that's probably one of the reasons I did make it through all of the bullying and all of those things that I went through and dealing with all of those emotions that as teenagers, especially teenage girls, we do deal with. And it is rough. But I had them to kind of, you know, give me that support and sit me down and, you know, let me know that I was loved and, you know, that I would always have that. And so that helped me get through a lot of it, that and my writing. And, you know, I decided then to never give that up, you know, to always use my writing as an outlet. And then later in life, you know, started sharing those stories and, you know, the poetry, the short stories, you know, other things, articles that I've written as a way to share that with the world so that other people could see, you know, they're not alone. You know, that's one of the things I've always tried to do is let others know I made it through and it wasn't easy. But, you know, if I did, you can too. And you're not alone. You've got other people there who understand you and can be there to help. But it's hard for some kids, I think, to reach out and ask for that help. And so maybe by sharing my story and others doing the same thing, maybe they will take that, you know, yeah, that knowledge and that experience and have the courage to reach out and ask for that help.
Yeah. And when you were in that moment, I can only imagine that you're probably feeling like, here I am exposing my inner darkest feelings and putting it to paper. And then your parents discover it. And you almost probably felt a sense of violation because they found it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were to go back to yourself and, you know, in that period of time and giving yourself some sort of advice, what would that advice be?
Well, basically that high school is not the be all end all of the world, that, you know, there's a much bigger, better, beautiful life out there after that. So if you can find a way to just survive that, to get through that as best as you can, to use it as what school was meant to be for, and that is learning. And luckily I had that too. I was a good student. I studied hard. I poured myself not only into my writing, but into my studies and, you know, tried to get that part out of it, you know? And so I think if kids can focus on that, that school is not a place where you're, you know, you may meet some friends there that you have for life, but really, you know, school is just supposed to be school. It's learning. It's supposed to be giving you the knowledge that you may need to help you in the next part of your life. It's not meant to be a place where you're going to find your lifelong friends. It's, you know, these people will be there now, but they will go away. They won't be there the rest of your life. So, and you will find other people that will love you for who you are and will want to be your friend. And, you know, I made my best friends way after school, you know, way after, you know, college years, working at different places. That's where I met my lifelong friends, at the stage where both of us had gotten past that young, you know, horrible stage. We were, you know, growing, we were pursuing careers and doing new things. And it's at that stage, I think, for a lot of us, where you're going to succeed, where you're going to meet those lifelong friends, those wonderful people who appreciate you for who you are. So just get through the school. Just do your best to get through it, survive it, because that is not life. That is not real life. And that's not the way life will always be.
Yeah. And I think it's really worth mentioning, and this is something that I did as a mom to help my kids when they were going through this uncomfortable period of time of change. And it looked different, of course, for them as it does for, you know, kids that are around the world with homeschooling and, you know, having being forced to do school from home. But one of the things that we had a conversation around quite often was that when we're doing something brand new, it is uncomfortable. It is something that we are scared of, and there is a lot of fear around it. And until we get into a groove of doing it, then it becomes more familiar and it feels better. And I think that level of discomfort is a very normal feeling, but you have to go through it. And I think just, you know, having the ability to talk through it is important, and just say, you know, I understand you're uncomfortable. It feels uncomfortable. And this is all very, you know, real and normal. Like, this is something that it's supposed to be like this, given this time, but it's not forever. We will get past this. And, you know, and we're right now, we're just going to do it the way it is right now, but it's not always going to be like this. There will be changes, because that's part of life. Life is constantly evolving and changing. So, and I agree with you, you know, part of the messaging too is that there will be people that are going to come in and out of our lives at different times. And that was another conversation that I would have with, you know, my children separately, because there was always some sort of discontentment with a relationship. And then it was trying to figure out the struggle around it. And part of that was just for growing. And I would tell them that, you know, this is an opportunity for growing. Right now is an opportunity for growing. Not to discount anything, but I know, you know, with there's something that you said that I thought was really profound. And it was just that when you were journaling, when you were putting these feelings in, and you had your mom and dad, and even though they found your journals and they read them and they had this concern, the thing that you said that I thought was so profound was that you knew you were not alone. And that's something that I would just remind everyone who's listening, and that it doesn't matter how old you are, you're never alone. There is always somebody there that can help you. And I'm just going to interject right here, because we are on the topic a little bit of suicide, that if there's anybody that's suicidal, please go and get community support, reach out to your mental health advocates and anybody that can support you in this journey, because it is so, so important. So did you want to jump in for a moment?
No, I just was going to say, I agree with you on that. You know,
yeah.
There's always help out there. You just need to have the courage to ask for it. And that's what I think a lot of people are afraid of, but no, there's so many people out there who have been through what you've been through. You aren't alone. So just take that little bit of courage and ask for that help if you need it.
Yeah. So as you start to go through your life, I mean, you go through your schooling, as you said, you have a new group of people in your life. And part of the new group of people, I mean, you're now in adulthood, right? So, So let's talk about where you are as an adult.
I was doing great once I got out of high school. And instead of initially going to college, because I had this, and it's just one of those teenage things, I guess, I had this fear, even though I was accepted to the two largest universities in Iowa, I couldn't get it into my head that there would be so many people there that I wouldn't be running into those same people in high school. But since, you know, all these same people I was going to school with were also going to be going to those universities, I just had this in my head that I was going to be running into them, that I was going to be dealing with those same types of people. And so I ended up, not taking the scholarships I was offered, which of course upset my parents. And I ended up signing up and going to travel school instead, because I was in Iowa, it was in Texas. I wanted to go to a completely different place and get away from the people I had been around. And I did end up discovering by going to this other school that, especially with these people who had no idea who I was, they had no idea where I lived. And so, my person had nothing to do with how rich my family was, what city my family lived in. And I suddenly was making all these new friends, people who liked me for me. And it gave me this whole new outlook on life. And that's when I started realizing that, okay, not everything is based on what you went through before. There are all these different people in the world with, different hobbies and talents. And, I started finding these people that I had things in common with, and it opened up a whole new world for me. And so even though later I somewhat regretted not going to college, when everybody else did, but at the same time, I really appreciated that new experience, what it opened me up to. And so, so after that, things were going great. And then I started working and was meeting those new friends and just experiencing a different part of life. And I was, doing so much better than I had in school. But as I, mentioned to you before, I guess there was still that little bit of, not being sure of myself and not having the confidence, having that low self-esteem, even, meeting these new people and having these new friends, that when I, started dating and, going through that part of life, I still ended up with a man who ended up abusing me, emotionally abusing me. And so then that started the next, chapter of my life and dealing with a new form of bullying, which was emotional abuse. And so then I, went into that, and I don't know what you want to talk to, with that, but yeah.
I just think it's, I just think the parallel is there, and you had said it, it was a similar thing, but now you're married to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so
how'd you get yourself out of that?
Finally, I went through over 20 years of that. And I didn't realize it until later that there are people out there who are master manipulators, who are so good at it that you can't even see what they're doing. And that's what I was in. And, because I would start feeling a certain way, and then he would change, all of a sudden it was this super sweetness would come out, and he would play it a different way until I forgot about, the things I was upset about. And it was sort of this, just domino, thing. It was just this circle over and over and over again of the same things. And so finally, after years of that, after going through a depression, losing more of my friends, and, family not talking to me, which was a lot because of him. He had a good way of keeping you away from family and friends and loved ones so that you did feel alone and you only would depend on him. And so that's, I think, where I was caught up and, constantly in, that continual kind of a spiral. And finally, I think I just reached a stage where I'd had enough. And I told you earlier, I found a book, which I wasn't looking for that type of a book. I was looking for something completely opposite. But I think, you know, it was God speaking to me that day that I was searching for books. And this book popped up in front of me called The Emotionally Abusive Marriage. And I bought it on a whim. And when he wasn't there, I would read this book. And at the end of every chapter, there was a quiz. And every single quiz I took told me that I was being emotionally abused. And, you know, it was written by a Christian psychiatrist, you know, who also used, you know, verses from the Bible, you know, to back up what she was talking about. And so it made me feel even more confident in my new knowledge. And it was the first step I think I needed, you know, was seeing that written down when I took these quizzes and then saying it out loud, admitting to myself that I was being abused and that, you know, I could admit it, that it was real, you know, that, you know, he no longer could lie to me about it. You know, I was truly now seeing it for what it was. And that was the first stage. And, you know, because I'm a Christian, you know, I talked to him about it. I told him that if things couldn't improve, that I wanted out. And we ended up going through Christian counseling because I did want to try everything I possibly could before I ended my marriage. And so we went through the Christian counseling and I started seeing other things through that too. Promises that he would make when we were in a meeting and then never following through on it. But yet I was expected to follow through with all these different things that we would talk about. And so finally, after that, and then there was one particular day when my daughter was visiting and he was angry over something and he was yelling at both of us and in our faces. And it got so bad that I didn't even realize what I was doing. I got an itch on my arm. And I started scratching it and didn't realize until the next day when I was looking in the mirror and I saw dried blood on my arm that I had scratched so hard that I'd caused myself to bleed. And when I went and looked up self-harm that day, because I had a niece who had gone through that. And when I read about it and realized that, you know, I was that person suddenly. That I was a person who had gone through something so awful that I had caused myself harm just as a way of coping with it, that was it. That was the last straw for me because I decided I wasn't going to be that person. I wasn't going to be pushed, you know, so far over the edge that became my new persona. And so that was it. That was my last breaking point. And so I went and talked to a lawyer and a few days later, he was gone. He was a truck driver. And so he was gone all the time on the road. And then the next day when he came home, I was sitting there and trying to figure out how to say it, how to tell him. And he finally looked at me and said, I see he could feel it. You know, there's something you want to say to me, just say it. And so that was it. It just burst out of me. And I said, I'm done. I am so done. I'm not going to be abused anymore. I deserve so much more than that in my life. I deserve to be happy. I was not meant for this. And I want out. I'm done. Mm. And I could not believe the relief that came over me. Finally, just getting it out there and saying those words. And I remember telling a friend, even when I went to get the money out of the bank to pay the lawyer that initial payment, that normally would have made me really nervous, but I remember walking out of the bank with a smile on my face, knowing that this is the start. You know, this is what I need to make this happen, to finally have my own life and to stop the abuse. And And after that, even though it was rough, you know, he was awful through the whole divorce, you know, thing. And it was always a fight over every little thing. But I remember thinking to myself, I don't have to take this anymore. You know, I don't have to listen. You know, all I have to do is get through. Because I told the lawyer, in Texas, you have to wait 90 days. And that's the quickest you can get, you know, to a divorce. And I told her, I don't want to argue over anything. I don't want to fight anything, even though you may tell me I can. All I want is it for it to be over. And that's what I told myself. So anything he argued about, I would tell him, deal with the lawyer. We drew up the papers and I just stopped listening to him. And I just had this new freedom and this new just sense of, you know, finally doing something for myself, that I finally had realized my true worth. And it felt wonderful. And there were days when I would think back on it and think, you know, kind of kick myself, you know, for it taking so long to get there, and thinking, you know, I could have felt like this years ago, you know? And so that was a little bit rough, but then I would remind myself that everything happens for a reason. Everything happens in its own time. And, you know, maybe I needed those extra lessons. Maybe I needed that extra time to get to where I was at that point. And, you know, but I was finally ready. And so then after that opened up a whole new stage of my life. You know, I finally got through and over that abuse, from the bullying as a kid through the emotional abuse as an adult. I finally learned to love myself enough to not put up with it anymore, and to finally start thinking of myself.
It's really incredible that you finally made that decision, even though it took as long as it did. You got to that space and time where you could just embrace it and know, okay, this is it. Like, I've had enough, this is it. And as you change through that process and, you know, really hold on to your self-worth, as you said, I mean, you do evolve into this new space. And at first it is uncomfortable, because part of you feels like, okay, you know, maybe there's a little shame around it, or maybe there's a little bit of a feeling like I failed, or these kinds of feelings, but they're quickly undone when you recognize that you're so much bigger and, you know, more beautiful as a person when you're outside of the confines of being abused consistently. So, I mean, it's remarkable that you're able to do that. And of course, if anyone's listening that is dealing with abuse, you know, again, get yourself some counseling, get yourself some support, because it's really, really important and vital for your well-being to have that support. But the next part of your story gets even more interesting, because you end up having a medical event.
Yeah, about a year and a half after the divorce. And, you know, I was doing great. I had my own business, and it was doing well enough that I was able to buy my own cute little house for me and my dog. And, you know, I was comfortable there and, you know, doing my own thing. And I'd even met someone new and was learning to love again, and realizing that there were people out there who really did love me for me. You know, there was no abuse involved and none of that. So all these great new things were happening. And yeah, about a year and a half after that, I had the flu one weekend and took myself to urgent care. They gave me a prescription for an antibiotic. And the next day, after I took that first antibiotic, within about 4 hours, I had lost feeling in both of my legs from the knees down and couldn't walk. So then I was rushed to the hospital. And at the hospital, they ran their own CT scan. The urgent care place had run theirs the night before, and all it showed was an infection, some inflammation on my abdomen. There was nothing else there. But less than 24 hours later, when the hospital ran their own CT scan, it showed my entire body from the kidneys down full of blood clots. So just less than 24 hours, somehow my body had filled with blood clots. I had lost feeling in, you know, both of my legs, couldn't walk. And so they rushed me into an emergency surgery, cut me open both groin areas, and started pulling out blood clots, you know, trying to get them out before one of them burst. And then during the surgery, the surgeon noticed my right leg had gone back to normal, but my left leg developed what they call compartment syndrome. And it's the, my leg had gotten so swollen, it was about to burst. So the surgeon then had to perform, they call it a double fasciotomy, where he had to cut my left leg open on either side of my leg to relieve the pressure to try to save it. And gratefully, you know, thanks to the Lord, I survived the surgery. And afterwards, after I woke up, the surgeon came and spoke to me. He explained to me what had happened and first told me that in all of his years of surgery, he'd never seen anything like it. And that I was lucky to even be alive with that many blood clots. And then he told me what happened with my leg and said, you know, you're lucky to be alive. I did this to try to save your leg, but it didn't work. Your leg and your foot are dead and we're going to have to amputate. And so that's what I woke up to. And I think it was, well, probably a mix of shock and just by the grace of God, instead of breaking down, I instead started praying and I started visualizing. And in my visualizing, I don't know where the image, why that's the image that popped up, but I pictured myself in the future, you know, walking in the park with my boyfriend and, you know, all body parts intact, being back to normal. And so for two straight days, I kept that image in my mind. I wouldn't let anyone who came into my room talk anything negative. I blocked it out and I continued to pray. And I thanked God for my life. I tried to remember gratitude and thanked him for my life that I was, you know, I'd made it through all of those blood clots. But then I also asked him for one more favor. And I, you know, just please, you know, I don't want to lose my leg. And I did that for two straight days. And on the third day, my leg came back to life. They got the Doppler and, you know, it was silent for 2 days, but suddenly there was a pulse and out of nowhere. And my coloring in my foot, which had been that awful kind of green, purple, and black coloring that tells you that the limb is dead, natural coloring came back. All that awful color went away. My color was back to normal. And then by the time the surgeon came in later, they had found a second pulse, which is what they really look for to know that the limb is okay, is two pulses. And so the next thing I knew, I had a room full of surgeons and doctors and nurses all standing around taking turns, listening to the Doppler, you know, checking my leg and my foot, because no one could believe it, because all of their facts had told them that my leg was dead. And then the only reason they hadn't amputated yet was because of everything my body had already been through. And it gave me that 2 days of prayer, which I once again believe was a miracle. And then I was blessed with that next miracle of my leg coming back to life. And when none of the doctors and surgeons could explain it, I was laying there in my bed, you know, basically pointing up and telling them it's a bona fide miracle. There's no other way to explain it. And you know, a lot of doctors and surgeons, you know, they're wonderful, but they're science people. And, you know, it's hard for them to admit that. But, you know, everyone who came into my room after that, that's what I would tell them. You know, I was blessed with a bona fide miracle. You know, there's no denying it. And so from there, you know, I was blessed with those miracles. And because then the next stage then was the surgeon telling me, okay, you get to keep your leg now, but I'm like, okay, what are the buts? And he said, well, you still don't have feeling, which I didn't. He said, so, and with nerve damage, we don't know if or when you will ever get that feeling back. And because of that, you will have a hard time learning how to walk again. You would almost have an easier time, he even told me, learning to walk if you had your leg amputated and were dealing with a prosthesis. That would be even easier. So it's going to be difficult and you could be a gimp the rest of your life. And up until that point, I hadn't broken down through this whole thing. And for some reason, him saying that to me is what caused me to finally break down and cry for the first time since all of this had happened. And so I got it out of my system. And, but once again, I reminded myself, I had already been blessed with miracles. So who was I to deny that anything is possible at this point? And so I listened to him. You know, he's the surgeon, you know, he knows what he's doing. But I told myself that wasn't going to be me. And then, of course, you know, he pointed out the wounds. And these two wounds were huge. And, you know, if I had been a queasier person, I actually don't know how I would have dealt with it. They were awful. And he told me that at least one of them, probably both, would not heal on their own. And I would need more surgery, a skin graft surgery, to heal the wounds. But I decided in my mind that, you know, I knew that extra surgery would mean, and of course, another surgery to heal from. Skin grafting meant that there would be another area of my body that would then have to heal and would have scarring. And so I decided in my mind that wasn't going to happen. And so when I started all of my therapy, I continued to pray, first of all. And at about the 2-month mark, I finally got feeling down to my ankle. And once I had that and I had that movement, for me, that was enough. Even though I still didn't have feeling in my foot, I started physical therapy and I told the therapist, you know, I understand I still don't have feeling in my foot and I've been told it's going to be difficult, but I will walk again. You tell me what to do. You're the experts. Whatever you tell me to do, I will do it because I will walk again. And I started with them and I gave them a deadline of about 6 weeks. They thought I was nuts at first, but in that 6 weeks, I went from using a walker and not even using my leg or my foot to going to a cane. And then by the time I left that hospital from physical therapy, I was walking on my own without a cane.
Wow.
And 6 week period. And then the wounds, I continued praying over them and continued, you know, doing my wound care therapy and, you know, doing whatever the doctors told me, you know, learned how to change my own dressings. I needed help with it. Luckily, my mom and sisters were there to help with that, because with two huge wounds, you need basically four hands to kind of hold everything. But I did everything they told me to do and kept working through that. And it ended up taking 7 long months, but both of my wounds did heal on their own without surgery.
That's remarkable. I mean, you hear these kinds of stories and you think, how is that even possible? But it's so incredible because the human body really is equipped to heal itself. And it's a matter of really seeing it through. And it, you know, your story is a testament of that. And it's just really remarkable that you were able to take all that energy and just put it into the spaces that needed the healing the most and manifest that. And you had mentioned several times just praying on it, praying to God around it. And there's so much to that. And I know that people of faith really understand the power of prayer, the power of that energy, you know, that you give yourself, but not just that, but, you know, into your prayer. So it's just remarkable to hear your story. And it's just awe inspiring, really. It really is. And I'm sure the audience is kind of at a loss of words around it too, to some degree. There's somebody out there that may be able to do better than I'm doing at the moment, but wow. I mean, seriously, it really is a beautiful, beautiful testimony, you know, to your self-healing, but something that we all can do and tap into, you know, especially when we feel like we have no control, right? And that's what you did. You took control.
Yeah. And there were still days, I will admit that, you know, that still happens. And, you know, there were days that were tougher than others. When my nerves started, you know, the feeling started to come back, it was probably the worst pain. I mean, I had kidney stones and that was pretty bad, but this pain of those nerves firing, trying to come back, I would still say is probably the worst pain I've ever dealt with in my life. And so there were nights I cried myself to sleep because the pain was so awful. But then I would remind myself that because there was pain there, that meant the nerves were trying to work, that that feeling was trying to come back. And so I would try to keep that in my mind, even through the worst of the pain. And, you know, and then luckily my poor mother had gone through shingles and we had talked about it a little bit, but it took me some time to really think about it, that this pain pill she was on was for nerve pain, because that's what they give to shingles patients. And because they kept telling me nothing will work on your nerve pain because it's nerve pain. And, you know, so I was just dealing with this. And finally, I ended up going to see my mother's doctor while I was staying with her. And I brought it up with her. And I said, you know, if there's any kind of relief I could get with this pain, anything at all that would help. I mean, I'm using my mind as much as I can and I'm doing my best, but there are still nights where I don't sleep because the pain is so bad. And her doctor told me, oh, I didn't even, you know, nobody thought about it. That yes, there is this nerve pain pill and it didn't completely get rid of the pain, but it finally got me to that stage where at least I could sleep at night. Yeah. You know, and get past some of that worst, you know, awful stuff. And so I reached out for help at that point. You know, I knew that I was having a rough time. And, you know, I also knew there were rules to follow with it because it's one of those pills that you have to wean yourself on and then wean yourself off of. And you have to be very careful with it. And so I reminded myself of that and, you know, told myself I'm going to use it through the worst of my pain, you know, get this help from this doctor who knew what she was doing, helping like my mother with her shingles pain, and finally got a little bit of relief. And so, you know, I will admit that ended up helping too, going to a doctor, asking for that extra help and getting it, you know, for a little while I really needed getting past that worst part of it. And then after a while, you know, the feeling continued to come back. And it got a little bit easier. So I ended up, you know, weaning myself off of those. And I still had some pain as it came back because it ended up taking almost 2 full years for the feeling to completely come back to my foot. You know, and doctors told me once again that if it got to be about a year and it wasn't back, it probably never would come back. But I kept telling myself, no, you know, I've seen miracles, so it can happen. It's just for some reason, you know, like I said, everything has its own time. And So I've surprised the doctor since then because with everything, basically, with learning to walk again and not being a gimp, with the wounds healing on their own without surgery, and then actually still having feeling come back into my foot after that year mark. And it taking, like I said, almost 2 years to fully get it back. But it is back. And, you know, I made it through those rough parts. And, you know, some of it was reaching out for help to doctors, you know, and asking for that extra help I needed and admitting it and knowing it was okay to ask for help. And then the other parts of it were just simple prayer, you know, that constant prayer. And then every little stage I went through, even though I knew I still had more healing to go and I still wasn't back to normal yet, remembering every single little thing that did happen, I said, thank you. You know, I praised God for every single little step of the way. And I think that's part of it too, is just knowing that, you know, He's there in all of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and so I talk to people a lot about gratitude too, and knowing that even in the rough patches, even in those awful stages, there's something to be thankful for. And if you can find that, which I tried to do constantly, it actually helps raise the mood, you know, raises that level, and it helps bring more goodness. At least that's how I looked at it. And I believe it now, because the more I focused on that gratitude, the more great things that came to me. And like I said, 2 years after that incident, you know, I have one little issue I'm still working on now. And it's the fact that because of the nerve damage, my toes curled a little. And so now I wear straighteners every day trying to get my toes straightened. But other than that, I am 99.9% back to normal from something that doctors told me I would not get back to normal from.
Yeah. And you're literally a walking miracle.
I am.
Literally a walking miracle that is wonderfully worthy.
Yes.
I love it. I love it. And, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And I know it wasn't easy. I know it was hard, but I hear in your voice the joy, the peace, the serenity, all of those things that you now are able to live because you're in that space. And, you know, sometimes I just think when we go through these seasons and, you know, they're right now, it feels like we're in winter as a globe, we're in winter, but spring is right around the corner. It really is. Like we're going through this season, but it's not going to stay the way it is forever. So I appreciate you sharing your story because it's just a testimony of how we can go through these periods of time in our life and go to the other side. And it is a forward movement that, I mean, it's different for everybody, but you're such an inspiration. You're such, you know, everything about it is just really remarkable. And I wanted to ask you, if I were to pick up your Earth Angel feather off of the ground, what would your message to the world be, Anne?
Oh, my message to the world would be that this life is a beautiful life. That, you know, no matter what you may be going through, no matter who you are, what you've done, where you've been, you deserve to live that beautiful life. And you're worthy of it. And no matter what stage of life you're in, you know, you may be in pain now, it is never too late to start living that life. You know, you were not put here on this earth to suffer. You were put here to soar and do great things. And no matter what stage you're at, it is, you can take a hold of that and rise up and live that beautiful life that you are worthy of living.
Wow. Like just wow. I mean, that is amazing and it's so beautiful. And I have to just express my deep gratitude for you being here with me, with this audience around the world. You're such a special human and you have such a remarkable story. And I'm just so privileged that you said yes to sharing it with all of us. So I'm so filled with gratitude. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you too. I appreciate you having me on here and allowing me to share, because I think it's important to share our stories so that everyone out there knows that you're not alone. You know, there are people there who understand and will be there to support you. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. So that's all we have time for today. This is Catherine Daniels with Retreat to Peace, reminding you to live your authentic life with peace. And as always, retreat to peace. And we'll see you next time. Welcome back. And what an incredible story Anne has that she shares with us and how she self-heals her body and saves her leg. And there's so many times that we hear about people like this and they're so inspirational because often we think, well, I don't know that I could do this for myself. And more often than not, we actually can. We can do this for ourselves just by keeping our faith, having our faith in God, having our faith within our bodies to self-heal and to do the work that needs to be done. And I love her perspective. And that's really what I wanted to talk about a little bit right now, is this idea of perspective. A lot of times our perspective is skewed. And I'm reminded of Genesis 50:20 in the Bible, where it's quoted, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. He brought me to this position so I could save lives of many people." You know, when you think about that, you think about what it is that you're going through and why were you presented some of the obstacles or the circumstances or the things that you've gone through in your life, and you question, why is this happening, or why me, or why this? You know, there's all these circumstances around it, and you ask yourself why. Maybe you've heard of Bethany Hamilton. She's a 13-year-old surfer, not 13 anymore, but she lost her arm in a shark attack in Hawaii. And her story is actually told in the movie Soul Surfer. Well, what's interesting about Bethany's story is when you ask her, why did she have this kind of tragedy at 13 years old where she lost her arm to the shark attack? She wouldn't say, why me? Her answer actually is, what for? Like, why did this shark attack happen? And why was there such media attention around it? But whenever a reporter would ask her about her shark attack and the arm, she would always have a very positive response to what happened. And she would always say, I could never have embraced this many people with two arms. And it just makes you think that, you know, when you go through difficult times, you have to resort to a place that, yes, we are experiencing something. Yes, things have changed. And yes, I have been gifted this opportunity for something that is of a higher good. And as Bethany shares her story, how many people around the world could relate to her, understand her position, or empathize with her. And a lot of times this idea of perspective, it challenges us. So sometimes we may look at something, a situation, or see something that we have a vision, and we automatically jump to a conclusion and we think that things are a certain way. For example, if I were to show you a blown up picture of a walnut, you actually might think that it was a rotten brain, right? But if you were to zoom out and you would see that it's not a rotten brain, that it's merely just an ordinary walnut, you then recognize that maybe your perspective is so close that things are skewed or things appear to be something that they're actually not. I think it's important too that we have to remember that time heals, right? So time has the power to put distance between us and the circumstances that cause our suffering. And during my interview with Anne, I was thinking about that too, because her perspective of what she had gone through has changed because she had some distance between when it occurred and her actually coming out and talking about it. So even though distance can help to ease our suffering, it can help us to stand back a little bit and also see a bigger picture. And often the only way to really see that bigger picture is just clinging to God or refusing to believe that he's abandoned us. And several times during the interview, she talks about that. She talks about her faith in God and how she prays and how she prays over her body. And the power of prayer is so remarkable. And we hear this over and over again. But we also get there just by listening and just by really staying in prayer, but also staying in touch with other people, people that can help us and support us through whatever it is that we're going through. And anyone who has ever gone through any kind of tragedy knows that the why me questions are coming up at times, but also when we step back and we often hear that we're not getting answers to that question. We step back and then we have to ask ourselves, well, what is this for? What is it that I'm supposed to learn from this experience? What is it that I'm supposed to do during this hour, during this time? And really plunge into that place of understanding that things don't have to look the way that they look. Now, one of the things that she also said is that she had a relationship that was verbally abusive and something that was, you know, very difficult for her to deal with. And unfortunately, during our journey, we do have these scars that we bear, and we have to recognize what it is we're going through. One of the things that people ask me often is about forgiveness. How do you forgive? And I often say the best way to forgive is to recognize that everyone is in a space where they're doing the best they can. And that's really true. I mean, everyone is doing the best they can, even though that's not the best place that we would be or how we would operate. But again, if they had different tools, if they knew how to deal with the circumstances differently, if they were able to see the world differently through your lens, do you think those same circumstances would occur? And if the answer is no, then you know in your heart that you can release it because you've done the best you can. And they have to address those issues on their own, and they have to work through them. So forgiveness work is often said it's a gift to yourself, and it is so true, because when you're harboring a lot of anger and you're harboring these intensity of feelings that you have, you're storing that in your body and you're holding on to it on a cellular level. The best gift you can give yourself is to release it. So ask yourself the question, are you doing the best you can? Are you giving yourself the gratitude, the space to do your healing work and to continue to heal? And if you're continuing to do this work and you're continuing to move forward, allow yourself to move forward with grace. And part of having grace is giving yourself the forgiveness work of understanding the perception of how things are and how things could be. Also, knowing that time will heal because the distance is going to create a safe space to generate a different perspective and give you the distance to do the healing work. So instead of asking, why me? Ask, what can I do with this? What am I supposed to use this for? What is this for? And allow yourself to be forgiving, allow yourself the grace, and allow yourself to see it through a different lens. And it will shape everything for you. Until then, this is Catherine Daniels reminding you to retreat to peace, and as always, live your authentic life with peace. We'll see you next time.